Hi, everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is A Good Story Is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies we love and the traces of the one reality that lie below the surface.
Mm-hmm. Year 8.
Oh, yeah.
Year 8.
Love it.
Yeah. Has it been a desert like in Three Godfathers, walking through the desert looking for water, or has it been different?
These last 3 weeks.
It's been the worst. 3 weeks, that's right.
I finally made it to cut the cactus out and drain it into my mouth.
Well, excellent. No more. Let the floodgates open.
Oh, they're opening, baby.
All right. Well, this is episode 174, and we are going to talk about a book called The Ships of Ishtar, or The Ship, sorry. No plural. The Ship of Ishtar by A. Merritt. A stands for Abraham. And this book was chosen by our guest. Our guest is Jeff Miller. Hello, Jeff.
Hi, everybody.
Yeah, Jeff does a blog. He's the Kurt Jester on the internet. His blog is at splendoroftruth.com. And I've got to say, his blog is a delight. It's often hilarious. But welcome, Jeff. Thank you for being on here.
Oh, it's great to be on. I mean, I've been on the other side of the microphone for the last 8 years, listening to every episodes. And before that, the connections with Julie through her blog and everything else. So it's a real delight to actually be participating in one of my favorite podcasts ever.
Oh, that's wonderful. Thank
Jeff, you. Well,
wow.
And I have to say, it's a bit surreal. I was sitting here and I was thinking, oh yeah, Jeff Miller. And then I suddenly went, oh my gosh, Jeff Miller. I read his blog before, you know, when I was new Catholic, before I ever thought of having a blog, much less a podcast. And now we're just palling around. The world is a crazy place.
it was a little bit over 15 years ago when I started blogging. At the time, I was a fairly new Catholic. And like both of you, I grew up an atheist and, you know, spent what I called 40 years in the wilderness of atheism. But, once I came into the Catholic Church, I wanted to, I wanted to talk about it. You know, I'm kind of inclusive, you know, and everything else, you know. But, so I wanted to talk about it. So that's why I started the blog. You know, it was never meant to be a humor blog. I thought it was going to be something serious. And I guess I didn't know myself at all.
Yeah.
Oh,
I still treasure, it's an old post, but I still treasure Mary's Fiat, frankly.
Yeah, that one makes it around, every year I see people reposting that.
Oh, that's wonderful. Yes. So what service did you start that blog on? Were you on America Online or something 15 years ago?
It was originally on Blogger.
Oh, okay.
Blogger.com. But yep. Within 6 months, I moved over to my own server and movable type, and then now I'm on WordPress. So
oh man, you get in trouble when it's on your own server. You know, save those emails and get them up to the State Department. You got to follow the rules on that.
Yeah. Well, I don't keep it in my own bedroom or anything.
Oh, okay. That's good. That's good.
Thank goodness.
That's lucky.
Yes.
Well, wonderful, wonderful. It's so great to have you here, and it's great
to
talk
to you.
Yeah,
we're so glad to have you here and be able to hear your voice.
Heck yeah. Love it. So this book, what on earth is this?
I cannot wait to hear your reasons for picking this book.
It's wonderful. So the book, The Ship of Ishtar, published originally in serial form in 1924, unless I'm mistaken.
Yes.
By Abraham Merritt. And I think the other or the most famous book that he wrote is called The Moon Pool. May have been the first thing that he wrote.
Yes, it was the first thing that he wrote. Very interesting guy. Abraham Grace Merritt is his full name. And as an author, this was basically just a side project. He was a fairly famous journalist and editor. And in fact, he was rather well off and rich. He was one of the highest paid editors at the time. And he did this for a long time. I mean, at the before his untimely death of a heart attack, he was making like $100,000 a year in the 40s.
Wow.
And so that was a considerable amount of money.
Mm-hmm.
And so he invested in different countries and everything else. And he did things like he sought out occult plants and everything else, you know, things that were used in the occult. And he would, you know, he had kind of a museum of them.
Oh, really?
And so this was kind of, you know, kind of laid into his stories. Mm-hmm. And then as an author, yeah, The Moon Pool was his first novel. He wrote 8 novels and a bunch of short stories. But, you know, he did pretty well. And for his day, he was very well known. You know, he's just like, his name is like totally forgotten now. I kind of, you know, ran into him by happenstance, you know, first reading The Moon Pool from LibriVox and everything else. And then, mm-hmm. you know, I never followed up reading anything else. And then this year, I kind of came across the name again. There's been a lot of talk of what they call kind of the pulp revolution. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of going back to some of these old books and everything else, and that, you know, there was a lot of good stuff out there, and, you know, that things that, you know, that we should read again and that we should look at. And, you know, we got, you know, you got the heroes, you got the fantasies, you got, you know, wild world, you know, crazy plots. And in the case of Merritt was actually a very good writer. I mean, he was very evocative in his prose. It's not purple prose, but, you know, he threw in a lot of adjectives and everything else. So he did pretty good. And unlike the sad story of so many, you know, pulp writers, you know, if you read some of their biographies, you know, things are horrific, you know, like Lovecraft and the guy that wrote Conan and everything else. I mean, these were like sad stories, but he influenced these people. You know, Lovecraft, you know, specifically mentions Merritt as one of his influences.
Yeah, I definitely believe that. And it's amazing how opposite Lovecraft's story is. You know, he's rubbing 2 pennies together, or trying, you know, eating cans of beans, you know,
things.
And A. Merritt is doing fantastic. That's great. Yeah. But mostly because of his other work, I imagine.
Definitely because of his work as an editor, and that he was a very good investor.
Mm, yeah.
So it's interesting to think that this was his kind of like entertainment in a way. This sort of pulp fiction. And I had read The Moon Pool as the original. It wasn't a short story, maybe, but I know it got expanded from a shorter work into a book. So I hadn't read the book.
It was The Moon Pool is definitely, you know, a thing of the time of, you know, lost worlds and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this book is less of a lost world. It's more of a refound world, you know, as it takes place where you have characters from Babylon 6,000 years ago that get, you know, mixed into the current world. And, you know, and a very interesting, you know, plot for the time. You know, it's something like this is probably more, you know, noticeable now, but back then for 1924, this was a pretty wild and crazy plot.
It would have been mind-bending, I think. I especially love the part where he's trying to, and we'll tell a synopsis, but I love the part where the people from Babylon are going, so what's the world like now? And he's like, oh, well, no one's ever heard of your city or this or that. And they're like, I don't believe you at all. Never mind. It's right here.
You're a liar. Basically yeah. What they call them, you know?
Yeah, exactly. I don't think so. And I probably should cut your head off for saying those lies, because that's the kind of place it is.
What I'll take away from this book, you know, for those of you who want to read it spoiler free before we do that, is, I mean, there are images from this book that I don't think will ever leave, you know, and they're good images. You know, the Ishtar, the ship is like a model. And, not unlike, you know, Edgar Rice Burroughs staring at Mars and just transporting to Mars, you know, this guy transports onto the ship that he's got in his hand, you know, this model. But yeah, it's half white, half black, but yeah, let's go ahead and synopsize. Well, what is this book about? What's the plot?
Well, basically, the hero, Kenton, receives this package, you know, from a friend of his, and he opens it up, and it's like a block, and then, you know, and it, you know, it comes into a, you know, a model of a ship, you know, and obviously a Babylonian, you know, a ship and everything else. And he looks at it, and there's like on the deck of it, there's, you know, like four people on it, you know, and including some beautiful woman and everything else. And, you know, he's just looking at it. So what is this? And then he starts noticing some strange things about it. You know, just like, this second, something's going on with my head. You know, things appear to be moving on it. And this ship is an avatar of a real ship that's somewhere else. And so the story involves him that he, you know, interacts and becomes into this world. And he kind of goes in and out of this world and keeps trying to get back into this world because he, you know, obviously in a pulp magazine, you know, novel, he totally falls in love with the priestess of Ishtar. And so the whole thing is a setup of, you know, of winning her over, you know, which, you know, is definitely a series of trials because she wasn't very thrilled with him, you know, thought he was, you know, was pretty weak. You know, he shows up with his awesome sword and he doesn't know how to use it and he doesn't know how to do anything, you know, and, you know, he can be taken prisoner by women, you know, type of a thing. So he was not impressed.
What a wimp.
That's right.
He's
that's
a modern man. And so because as he goes along, I did love the parts where they'd have little bits in the book of, oh, now you're going to be a galley slave. But as he's being a galley slave, he's like developing these awesome muscles.
Mm-hmm.
She's going, oh, you know, I don't remember you looking like that, my king.
Heck yeah. Yeah.
So I interrupted. Sorry, Jeff.
Yeah, but, you know, so, you know, the whole thing is, so, you know, you have your typical trajectory of, you know, you got the bad guys and you're going to defeat them at the end. So, you know, that's the basic synopsis. But what you have, you know, the imagination of this is that, you know, things are going on as he interacts with his ship, and that time flows differently in his world and in the world of the avatar ship that he comes into, you know, that, you know, when he leaves and everything else, his injuries that he receives, you know, they're not healing as fast. And when he joins with them later on, you know, they're remarking on the fact that time flows differently in his world because they're all like recovered and everything else. And, you know, and he's still injured.
Right, right. Yeah. So the version that I have, yeah, that was a great synopsis. So
yeah,
the version that I have, it's says presented by Tim Powers, has sort of a cartoon Shireen on the front. Shireen is the name of that girl that he was after. But I wanted to read just a quick paragraph. Tim Powers wrote this opening. It says, on these strange seas in this strange world. But I'll read this just to see what you think. It says, this novel, and again, this is Tim Powers writing, this novel, like the ship of Ishtar itself, is timeless, the opposite of timely. And in fact, it may not be possible to write a book like this in these present times. Somehow, in the early 1920s, Merritt managed to write a genuinely pagan book, one that didn't simply deal with, but assumed, the pre-Christian fatalist dualism with its particular loyalties and indifferent cruelties. A modern writer would not let Kenton deal with slaves and conquered crews the way he does, and would be constantly aware of Freud and political correctness. A modern writer, that is to say, would not be able to unself-consciously let the story play out naturally with no placatory gestures toward modern sensibilities. And then, this was interesting what he mentioned here, like E.R. Edison's The Worm Orbros, or Hope Mirless's Lud in the Mist, or James Branch Cabell's The Cream of the Jest, The Ship of Ishtar is an anomaly, a book that is its own category, magical and unique. We're fortunate to have it.
So that's good.
That's Tim Powers, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, as a major Tim Powers fanboy, that's a great synopsis and really gets down to some of the interesting things about this book, because it does assume a pagan worldview, and it does assume that fatalism, and it also looks at, you know, the capriciousness of the gods. You know, yes. As to, you know, and there's even a kind of a philosophical point to it, talking about, you know, free will and, you know, would good God allow, you know, punish, you know, the people that he created and everything else. So there's that kind of background in it, too, which is pretty interesting.
Yeah, agreed. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the idea of fantasy itself as well is something that was interesting to me. You know, a modern person, you know, longing for something else. That to me was an interesting theme. Go ahead.
Yeah, but I think that's a common theme too in a lot of the pulp fiction, because mm-hmm. what it does is it allows the author to go, oh, we're just going to cast this off because you don't have a choice. You know, you're stuck in this very alien world. And if you don't adapt to it in the way they want you to adapt, then you're going to die. So it allows them to kind of just open it up and explore it. You know, what would it be like to be in this pagan world? And you see that with John Carter of Mars and various other things too.
Mm-hmm.
I guess now we can dive in.
Yeah, right? Dive in. Absolutely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that was the thing that struck me is, of course, Tim Power said it much better than I could, but I was thinking about it this morning, thinking, yeah, this is a world that shows you exactly a lot of the problems with paganism. If those gods really existed, and of course, the Catholic thinking on that is that those pagan gods that were worshipped, if miracles were happening or whatever, it's because they were demonic. But it's that idea that you're completely at their mercy. Mm-hmm. And it makes me think of a book that I'm reading right now called God or Nothing by Cardinal Robert. I don't know how you say
Sarah's
name. So is it Sarah, not Sarah?
Sarah.
And he talks in the beginning, he tells his life story, and his parents remembered, you know, they're the generation that remembered what it was like to be pagans and then what it was like to have the French missionaries come. And he said it was a life of fear and violence because you didn't know what these gods were going to do, so you would propitiate them however you needed to. And then the truth actually set them free. You know, it sounded idyllic. And he said, if it sounds idyllic, people think I'm making it up, but it wasn't. It was, we were living the way we were supposed to, with the Christian missionaries showing us, look, you don't have to worry about that stuff. And it makes a really strong contrast with this book. He's having these great adventures, but every so often the gods come in and possess someone or just take a hand and everything goes to hell, literally.
Mm, yeah. That's right. Unpredictable.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah, and moody.
Yeah,
right.
What one of the interesting things about this novel, you know, we have lots of stories, you know, that you know, and tropes involving, you know, somebody transported to another land, you know, and they mm-hmm. have to deal with this, you know, the modern person that goes back, you know, into either a fantasy world or a place with magic. You know, we have tons of those, but this one is interesting in that. Since he interacts with this, he actually, you know, leaves the ship and heads back home. And then it's conscious choice that he wants to return, that he wants to enter back in. He's not like he's, well, I'm trapped in this world. You know, I don't know what to do, but I'll just do the best I can. He's actually participating in and becoming, you know, the kind of the hero of going back on purpose to do everything. So that's a little bit different than many of the other stories, you know, that. You know, there's some, you know, that are around.
Yeah, yeah, there and back again stuff. But yeah, he's like, not only that, but he wants back so badly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, every time that he's thrust back into the modern world, he's like, no, I'm not ready, you know. And then he immediately turns around and goes back. But that in that immediate time, you know, time passes while he's gone, you know, on the ship, right?
Oh, right.
Yeah, so... But I love that imagery of how he does that too, you know, grabbing like a little chain on the toy and then concentrating and then suddenly being in the ocean, you know, being dragged by the chain and climbs mm-hmm. up the chain onto the deck. It's just awesome. Really great.
Yeah, I loved the way it was written.
Mm-hmm.
You could really see and feel everything.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and it's his love for Shireen that eventually is what calls him back again and again. He can't bear to leave her.
Mm-hmm. That's right. That's right.
And he's always trying to prove himself, you know. You know, originally, you know, Shireen's telling him, you know, said, well, you know, I'll help you escape it, you know, if you do these certain things for me. And he wanted to do everything on his terms. He says, well, I'm going to escape on my own, and I'm going to do all this, and I'm going to prove myself to you and everything else, because she wasn't confident that he was going to be able to pull this off at all.
Yeah. Did you guys both see Star Wars, the new one?
Yeah.
Yes, I.
Okay. This thought, occurred to me a little bit ago. You know, so this ship, Ishtar, it's got the black and the white, sides, that are constantly at odds with each other, and fighting. And this is kind of a pagan viewpoint, right? Where, in Star Wars, they were talking about, was both the Jedi and Kylo Ren were talking, or not Kylo, but his boss.
The Emperor?
Snoke.
Snoke. So yeah. they were both talking about how, when I get powerful, the opposite is also going to come. It's going to rise to meet me, right? So like when good gets powerful, the evil is going to come up and meet me. But
that's Gnosticism.
That's exactly what I was going to say. I wasn't going to use the word Gnosticism, but that is an interesting viewpoint. It seems to be the same viewpoint as in Ishtar, the same kind of a worldview that's presented there. So why do you say it's Gnosticism?
Well, basically, that there's a good God and an evil God, and they're equally balanced. Mm-hmm. And so that's that you have to find the hidden knowledge to be able to interact with the situation of the world that you're in.
Right.
But or more specifically, it's kind of like the cult that St. Augustine was part of.
That's what I was thinking. Is the Manichees? Is that it?
Yeah, the mm-hmm. Manichees. Yeah.
Manichees. Got it.
Yeah. The Manichees, definitely had the good God and bad God dualism. The yin and yang type of dualism that we find in the Oriental cultures, same types of ideas.
Yeah,
because Gnosticism is also, and it's more about you also have to have the hidden knowledge
mm-hmm.
That only a certain few can have.
Right.
Basically the Matrix.
Yeah, probably what I know most about Gnosticism is, the focus on knowledge and knowing the secret things. Or knowing the right things, in order to get you through.
But it's kind of logical,
a Dan Brown version of the world.
Yeah.
That's right. But anyway, I don't know if that's a interesting road or not, but it does seem to be the same worldview presented here on the ship of Ishtar as where Star Wars is headed, maybe. We'll see.
And that's interesting because I hadn't really thought about it, but it's the light and the dark, and they'll fight each other, but they're still, as in the book, as Jeff was pointing out, he keeps choosing to go back. It's his choice. He's using his free will to go back into that situation where your free will doesn't seem to matter a lot of the time, thanks to the pagan gods. But the Star Wars movie is the same, because at that one crucial moment, and Kylo Ren's going, come on, we could build something new together.
Mm-hmm.
And of course we know and hope that's not going to happen. And then she chooses, no, I'm not doing that.
Yeah.
So, mm-hmm.
Yep.
I wouldn't have thought of that parallel. That's interesting. I loved you were talking about the imagery. I really loved once they finally got off that darn ship. Eventually, I was like, the ship again. Super. And they got into the town and the city. And both, to me, that's where it took off. I mean, I was interested at the beginning, and then I felt like there was this bit of a sag for me in the middle, because he kept going back to the ship and more fighting and back to the ship and more fighting, which is usually my problem with swords and sorcery, which is kind of what I thought of this book as being. And they got to the town, though, and now you're seeing more of the people's own actions. He's making all those wrong decisions that many people make in these situations. They said to wait, but I'm not going to. I'll go here and sit in the garden. No one will know it's me, right? And but you got to see the whole place, a lot more people. And to me, that really moved it along, because everybody there is not under the gods' influence as much. Or if they are, it's more peripheral. that was more real worldish to me.
Hmm.
And that's when I was much more interested to see how everybody was interacting. And maybe it was more like a, I don't know, Indiana Jones at that point than Conan.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting you put it that way. Yeah, Indiana Jones versus Conan.
And the king that they had was quite the character himself, you know, that he can do all these things because he doesn't believe in any of it.
Right.
You know, he doesn't believe in gods, and all the priests are parroting every word he says about how great he is, and you know, and everything else. But you know, there's the fatalism in that too, when you know, when he has a servant girl, you know, killed because she didn't serve him wine fast enough and everything else, and then has the archer killed too for not doing it quick enough.
Yeah.
And then he goes on to wax on his, on the poetry and everything else, you know, about life and everything else, where Kenton goes, oh, I know that poem and everything else, and impresses the king by being able to complete what he's saying, and becomes kind of a buddy with him and everything else.
So, mm-hmm.
so there was, you know, kind of interesting stuff going on there too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that's it. All the different personalities that allowed the author to really kind of broaden his scope at that point. You know, because then they were back to the ship. But at least it wasn't just one battle after another. They were at least going somewhere different for a change.
Yes.
Again, this is my own limitation. I know this. So I did like it. But it was just, I was reading it going, wow, only Jeff could have gotten me to read an entire Swords and Sorcery book. I tend to give up on them. And I was glad I didn't. You know, I was forced to read the whole thing. So I'm glad you picked it.
Well, as someone that read all the Conan stories this year, you know, that I wasn't knowing what they're expecting, but it's part of my, you know, of the novels I was, you know, experimenting with last year. And, you know, I found that I enjoyed those a lot. And those were also very well written and not exactly what I was expecting.
Oh, in what way?
Yeah.
Well, because it's, you know, it's not like, you know, Conan's this barbarian from the wilderness that, you know, that starts out slowly and then, you know, grows in fame and everything else, you know. The first story, he's already a king.
Yeah.
And it goes on. And, you know, and then he has downfalls where he loses his power and comes back again and goes on all these, you know, different, you know, side adventures and all these different stories. So it's quite a different, you know, canon of stuff. I'm looking forward to author John C. Wright's going to be writing a bunch of posts on the Conan stories as he's read through them again. He's going to be reflecting and writing about them, you know, because, you know, I think he picked up on some of those same things that, you know, he was a much better author than he expected him to have been.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Jesse at SFF Audio talks about Conan all the time. Yeah, says, you know, much the same as you. Yeah, it's not what you think. If you haven't read them before. Yeah.
Darn you both. Stop it. You're going to make me have to try them again.
I haven't read one myself ever, so maybe I ought to try one.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm thinking of reading the Solomon Kane stories, you know.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
those are also supposed to be pretty good, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Puritan Warrior.
Yes. That's right down our alley, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe an audiobook format. I'll do better.
Maybe so.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to try one again.
That's excellent. Are you reading anything else from this period?
I kind of float back and, you know, in and out and everything else, but I'll definitely be exploring some of those things. And then I definitely want to go back into the Edward Rice Burroughs stuff, you know, I dip in and out of there all the time because, you know, that was another amazing of the pulp authors that was just, you know, should be credited much more, you know, for what he did and just the amount of stories that he wrote, you know, just amazing, you know.
Yeah, yeah, so many. Yeah, every now and then I read one of the Mars novels or Tarzan. I like Tarzan books 1 and 2 most.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, I love Tarzan. You know, this was a totally different. You know, as somebody that grew up on the Tarzan movies and everything else, and you know, just a second. You know, this isn't even the same story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because, yes.
You know, you know, Tarzan, you know, is quite the intellect. I mean, he taught himself to read before he left Africa. He's already speaking French. You know, it's just the total opposite. You know, he's able to pick up on all this stuff. You know, he can speak to animals and he can speak to humans, you know, quite well, you know.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. The first time you discovered that after just seeing the Me, Tarzan, You, Jane stuff, yes. You're just like, what? Where did they, why did they do it like this? This is ridiculous in the movies. The books are so much better. Yeah, Edgar Rice Burroughs, I really do like. The Tarzan, the first Tarzan books especially. I've never really gotten into the Mars ones, but I do love his Lost World series.
Mm-hmm. Pellucidar? Isn't that what they call it?
Oh, maybe I'm thinking, nope. You know what? I'm thinking of Arthur Conan Doyle. Sorry.
Oh, okay.
Got it mixed up.
Yeah, that was, yeah. Yeah.
Got it mixed up.
I'm with you.
Yeah.
The Lost World.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, the other thing I liked about this Ishtar, the Ship of Ishtar, is that the trials turn him into who he's meant to be. If the person he is in love with or naturally feels an affinity for is there and he needs to impress her or, you know, live in a way that she can understand and he continually is leaving his world as fast as he can, no matter how badly he's hurt, so he can get back there. That's where he feels most at home. But all the things he goes through, you know, being a galley slave, being captured and tortured, this god attacking him directly, they all turn him into somebody better, stronger, faster, more attuned to who he should be. And that's cool.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and the great thing is his companions. You know, they're not just they're all enjoyable. You know, they're just like great characters. You know, you basically have the Viking and everything else who when their friendship starts up, he takes the whip for him. You know, to keep him from getting beaten. And then okay, you know, you're my bud now. You know, I didn't know about you before, but you know, you're my bud. And so, you know, that's a great character. And then there's the guy with the whole side story of, you know, he went bald and, some women don't like him anymore. And so he's on this quest to find this plant to make be able to grow hair again. Yeah. I mean, there's just so many things that are fletched out, you know, that are just oddities that make it more fun.
Yeah.
That is one of the things that I liked about when he got to the city, maybe because all those people got to have more to do. Because you're right, I did love his buddies. They were the best. And the guy who, the other guy who's part of the, he's trusted by the person in power on, I can't remember his name now, on the side of the Ishtar ship with all the men and the god of war. And because he's just very bored with everything. He's looking for enough adventure. Am I right on that? Am I remembering that right?
Yeah, I believe so.
Yeah. And nothing that you can do is going to be enough adventure for him until the very end or his very end.
Yeah, I loved what you said about, you know, him finding, you know, turning into his true self, you know, by that. You know, that makes me think of vocations, you know, from a Catholic point of view. This idea of, you know, finding what it is that God wants you to do and how that changes you.
It's true, it's part of, I became a book lover, you know, mainly with, you know, it was science fiction. It was Asimov that turned me into a reading junkie. And so science fiction was, I mean, that was like, you know, 95% of everything that I read. And I didn't read fantasy at all because I almost disdained fantasy. You know, it was like, this, you know, give me Hal Clement, you know, hard science fiction and everything else, you know, that, you know, it's kind of pride and everything else. So I just want the real science. And there's all this stuff, all these fantasy characters, you know, they're not very good. So, you know, I just, you know, I didn't read Lord of the Rings till I was in my 40s because of that attitude, you know. But once I, you know, discovered, you know, kind of fantasy, you know, I was all in. But fantasy was something, you know, you always have, you know, you have the hero's journey over and over again about people, you know, going past their limitations and becoming who they're supposed to be. And mm-hmm. I saw this in myself, you know, as an atheist, you know, I go, you know, why do I love these stories so much? I mean, these people are virtuous, you know, I love them because they're doing what is right in a hard situation. And I was looking at myself, well, I'm not doing that. You know, why am I so attracted to these characters that are doing what was good when I wasn't doing what was good? And so that, you know, it kind of set me on a journey too, you know. I joined their journey in a way, you know, try to become more of what I should be.
Hmm. Wow, what a good reader. I mean, golly, it took me years. I mean, a lot of my life to be opened up to thinking the way you're thinking and just kind of going thinking of my own life plus against what I'm reading and what do I like in it. God, I admire that, Jeff. What a thinker.
Well, it took a long time. That's for sure. It was not overnight. That's for sure.
As it is for all of us, right? Well, yeah. And that's the thing. I think, you know, Scott expressed it well with vocation, but, you know, it's also you look back on your life, you get to a certain age where you can kind of go, oh, this thing I hated so much either sent me down a different path or made me have to fight through, and then these qualities developed. And this is, you know, our path on earth, but it's also God's way with us. It's that thing of, well, I can't get you to do what is best for you this way, so you're just going to have to fight through what you made for yourself. Hmm. And if you're lucky and it's not a destructive path and that you just won't leave for any reason, then you can become more than you were. You know, your full potential can be attained.
Yeah.
Well, as C.S. Lewis wrote, you know, it says, you know, to remain an atheist, you have to be very careful about the books you read.
Yes.
You know, and isn't it funny how a lot of Christians think it's the opposite? You know, they're so worried about the books that you might read that might give you an idea that might fester into atheism. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, it's just interesting, you know, the opposite viewpoint, you know, because that's the viewpoint I've heard even more often. You know, don't read science fiction because that'll make an atheist out of you.
Harry Potter, yeah. Don't even let your kids look at it. It's got magic. How many times have I fought that argument?
That's one of the things that I think was one of the things that made this podcast interesting to do, you know, at the beginning, you know, when we had the idea was, you know, keeping your Catholic glasses on when you're reading, you know, rather than you know, actually giving some things some thought, you know, which is what we've
done. I mean we have the whole history of reason and applying, you know, critically. We can look at a story and we can see the flaws, we can see where the worldview is wrong, but we can still enter into that worldview to see how, you know, something works out or doesn't work out, and, you know, what does it mean to live in this world.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and in a lot of science fiction, it's like, you know, what could our world become? You know, positive and negative. Where are we going from here? You know, some of it. Not all of it.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What are the ideas that are being put forth, and how do you use those? I mean, a lot of times the things you read in fiction are things that you can then use when you're talking to other people.
Hmm.
Yeah. You know, they bring up the examples, whether good or bad, that you might never think of yourself. I mean, I think of, oh gosh, not 1984, but there's another book like that where, now I'm blanking on the name. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's not a separate piece. Sorry. Mm-hmm. There's a whole category of books that I didn't really like reading, but they had the ideas that you needed to have anyway. And this is one about the future world where the babies are all in test tubes and they're using electric shocks to program the kids and everything. And an Indian gets brought in off the reservation to live in this brave new world. I was going to say to live in this better new world. Wait a minute. So close to
the Soma and everything.
Right. But yeah, so you look at that book now and you just think, wow, that author was prescient. A lot of that kind of thinking has bled into modern society. And so then you can take that and it forms a common springboard from which to have conversations with people.
And it's interesting that Aldous Huxley was a very fervent atheist, but you know, he was able to project some of these moral things, you know, of the coming world that, you know, a lot of atheism would kind of accept now.
Yes.
Yeah, no question. Yeah. And that's an interesting thought. You know, the Catholic Church is viewed so often as, you know, telling everyone to stop, you know, but what it is, you know, I like to think that it's a consideration of the implications of what is going on, not just, hey, you're being immoral, you should stop doing that. Because a lot of people just are not thinking that way. It's like, you know, do you realize, well, like, for example, something that horrified me that I saw in the last 2 months of 2017 was a tweet in which it said, I think it was Iceland, has all but cured autism or Down syndrome kids.
Down syndrome, yes.
Yeah, and the way that they did that is they abort them. That's not a cure. They're like, you know, so, you know, cure is in quotes in, you know, the way that I say it. It wasn't in quotes on the tweet. It was like, hooray, look what we did. And I'm like, are you kidding? You know, that wasn't a cure, you know, and just the implications of what's the next step there, you know, and we're all aware of that, you know, what comes next. But somebody needs to consider that.
Well, considering that I think it's like 90% of Down children are aborted, and that's in the United States, that statistic is that high.
Yeah.
So it's not like just Iceland. It's already happening here. It's the new eugenics, you know.
That's one of the things.
We're going back to the 20s and 30s when eugenics was all the rage. Mm-hmm. You know, most people don't realize how many states had eugenic laws. And just how fervent in the society that it went into. It was basically only the aftermath of Nazi Germany that, you know, people said, oh, my God, those ideas that we adopted and we actually gave them to Hitler, these might not be a good idea.
I'm glad you said that. I think that's what I need to try to remember when those kind of conversations come up. I don't have them very often, but I need to be able to remember to drop in, just like the Nazis. They didn't like a certain kind of people either, because that's people kind of forget that, you know, if they remember eugenics, they're not thinking of it in the same way at all because it's become such a part of our society. And then when they think of the Nazis, they think of, you know, just horrors, which is correct, but they forget that was just an extension of that whole way of thinking, you know, used for different, you know, for various reasons and all this kind of thing. Right. It's like people forget why Planned Parenthood got started. Somebody who said, let's put this in the black neighborhoods of town, shall we?
Margaret Sanger, as part of what she originally had, the Birth Control League, which became Planned Parenthood. Some of the people that she worked with actually went into Nazi Germany to advise Hitler on what they were doing in the United States. So she worked with people that directly worked with Hitler. Because they thought these were a good idea. And people forget that in Nazi Germany, really the first victims were in the hospitals when they started euthanizing.
Mm-hmm.
The mentally ill, you know, the unfit, you know, these were the first victims before it expanded.
Yeah, and what the Catholic Church would tell you is essentially where there's life, there's hope. We can never tell what path a person's life is going to take. We can never tell how they are going to affect all the people around them for the better. You know, it's a complex web of things which people would look at and say, oh, the environment, it's a complex web. Don't mess with it. Well, people are part of that too. And we in our society are part of that. And when you just start chopping out pieces of it, it's harmful to both the big picture and the individual, which is the church is always on the individual side. So that's, it's during, a recent conversation I was having, somebody brought up Chesterton, G.K. Chesterton, saying, you know, when you come to a fence or a gate in the road, before you just rip it down because there's no reason for it to be there and it's impeding progress, stop and look at maybe why that gate was put up in the first place. Do we need to think about what's on the other side that somebody once felt there was a problem with? Because when you stop and consider everything, you may then say, no, this is okay. But a lot of times you look at it and go, oh, there are broader implications. There are things that we didn't think about yet Now that we've gone back and asked this question, here we are. And that's what the Catholic Church does. They're like, you know, we're all for progress, despite what most people would tell you. But we want to think about what's the cost to humanity, to each human life.
Yeah.
And that's where a lot of people would rather just look at the big picture, because it's not me it's happening to.
Well, that was a mind reading moment, Julie, because I was just about to bring up that Chesterton quote about don't remove a fence until you, you know what it's there for, you know, because that's what I was thinking of. And then you brought it up. So that's nice synchronicity there.
Yeah. We can thank SFF Audio. I was talking about The Man Who Was Thursday with Jesse and some people there, and they actually brought that up to me as an example of how he was a small C conservative. And did I agree with this? And I was like thinking, I didn't say at that point, I don't think. I was like, as a Catholic, yes. Mm-hmm. Because you have to take into mind, you know, this idea that progress can only go forward is kind of, you know, it's disrespectful to everybody behind us who also, they weren't dummies. We like to think they're dummies and we're the smartest people that ever were, but no, not really.
Well, yeah, and we think about that word progress, too. I mean, that bugs me because, you know, when we read, you know, Plato, it's very clear that they're dealing with the same problems that we're dealing with. It's not like, you know, we're so enlightened nowadays and we're so much better than they were. Another thing that comes to mind is, you know, C.S. Lewis said something about old books and how, you know, every time has their flaws. They're blind spots, yeah. Right? And that's the value of the old books, that we're reading people from times that don't have our specific flaw. You know, they've got something going on that may not be complete or whatever, but if you read only the modern stuff and forget everybody that came before us, you're blind to what the problems are right around you.
You know? Yeah, I used to have a very ageistic snobbery, you know, towards, you know, oh, this is an old book. I mean, those people back then, you know, what do they know? You know, we have science now. We have reason. You know, we have my own kind of embedded scientism that I held and everything else. And so, you know, I turned my nose at, you know, at reading these authors or these philosophers and everything else. And, you know, it was only later on that I said, wow, there's things really don't change, do they? You know, you can go back and read like St. Augustine's Confessions and, you know, yep, I can relate to pretty much everything in there. And his follow on City of God, the human condition is the human condition. It doesn't change because of time. And these ideas of progress, you know, we have an idea of a progress without actually naming what the goals are.
Right.
That's interesting.
Chaotic.
Yeah,
progress.
Not like we're gonna go. We'll go to the moon because it's, you know, not because it's easy, but because it's hard. I mean, that's kind of really laying out. Here's what we're doing. Here's our common goal. You know. Well, also we would like to beat the Russians, but that's, you know, here's the bigger picture. Yeah, and I'm rereading Deuteronomy right now, and it's a lot of it is, you know, Moses going, okay, and does everybody remember this? And I'm reading the part about, you know, a man shouldn't sleep with his mother's or his wife's mother. So if he does, here's what you do. And I'm just like, man, we just do not change.
Oh man. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
Yep. How about that?
That's right. Yeah, but it's amazing, you know, just, you know, the last 100 years of books, you know, after, you know, that it's really, you know, taken off, you know, compared to because of the ability to be able to write novels and everything else, and just all the different genres and everything else and everything else. But, you know, so, you know, I found that I'm a kind of a both and kind of person. So I'm finding that I'm enjoying the old stuff. I'm enjoying new stuff and everything else. But I also look at, you know, Sturgeon's Law. Sturgeon's Law is, yeah. You know, that, you know, 90% of science fiction is crap, but 90% of everything is crap.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
And one of my favorite sayings ever. In fact, I met Frederick Pohl once. And,
oh, nice.
That's where I learned that, because he said that. And that was like glued into my brain after that. So,
yes.
Dang, that describes everything. You know, there's a lot of books out there, and, you know, there's about 10% of them are really worth reading and everything else.
Mm.
And trying to find those 10%, well, you go through a lot of the 90%.
Yes.
Yeah, That's great.
Exactly.
That's great. I like to follow you both, you know, and see what you guys are reading. You guys read so much more than I do. But yeah, I always, you know, get good book suggestions from both of you.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. Well, I definitely keep up with Jeff's Goodreads. He's always reading. You're always reading a lot of stuff that it might be different, but I'll find things and go, ooh. So, yeah, you're out there helping winnow down that 90% for me into the 10%.
Well, that's the nice thing about the whole, you know, of social networking. You know, there's definitely always downsides in all these technologies and everything else. But it's happened to focus my reading, you know, a lot more. You know, you find people that you trust in their reading taste. Mm-hmm. You know, oh, okay. You know, these people recommend books that I actually that I read them. Oh, yeah, that was a good book. You know, well, let's see what else they like and everything else. And so my reading is much more focused. It used to be that, well, I would just grab something off the shelves at the library. And so, you know, go through a lot of stuff on that, you know. But so it's much more directed now, which, you know, makes it, you know, read a lot better books overall.
Yeah.
And it just brings you, it just shows you everything else that's out there. And so I use it for that. Like I follow you and various other people for the very same reason. And then, but then there, the other way is like, I'll follow Jenny Colvin, who I met via SFF Audio, because she's always reading really new stuff. And almost all of it is not stuff that I'm that interested in. But I can kind of keep my finger on the pulse of what are all the new books, what are people writing about, what are the trends, you know, because she always writes pretty good reviews, too. So I'm always interested in seeing what she says about them. But so that's the other way is I don't have to read like the New York Times book review. I can follow certain people and go, oh, here's what everybody else is doing, you know.
Yeah, yeah. So I follow her. And then on YouTube, I don't know if you guys look at BookTubers at all, but there's this one fellow, I think his name is Tom, SFF180 is one that I watch almost every week. On Monday, he posts, you know, the publishers send him everything that comes out. And these are science fiction and fantasy.
Okay.
And I watch that once a week, and for the exact same reason. You know, it's actually rare nowadays that I see one that I really would love to read. That's coming out nowadays. But every now and then it does happen. But at the same time, by watching his new releases, I have my finger on the pulse and I can, you know, see again, what, just like what you said, what people are writing about, you know, in the science fiction world. Unfortunately, in the science fiction world, it's like, you know, you get something that's unique and really awesome, and then you get 150 of the same
thing. Yes.
You know, so, you know, for a while we had Buffy clones for years, it seems like.
Yeah.
Oh,
Buffy
yeah.
the Vampire Slayer
Vampires
clones.
Vampires everywhere.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, so, zombies.
Well, I picked up the Ship of Ishtar, you know, mainly because of the discussion in Pulp, but directly from, I think it was Gary Gygax, the guy that made Dungeons and Dragons. In the book, in the back, they have this thing, I think it's called Appendix N, where he basically, you know, references all of his sources for ideas, you know, all these different novels that he thought that people should read that he, you know, he picked up on this world on.
Hmm.
And there was a guy, I think is Gerald Johnson's his name. He decided that he was going to go through Appendix N and read all these books because they were not canon for him. He didn't know these authors. You know, he was only aware of the newer authors. And so he describes his journey reading all these classics, including, you know, A. Merritt is specifically mentioned by in the Appendix N. So all these classic sources. And so that's a very good book to get to go through because, you know, he's going through reviews of these things, and other people have picked up on these same types of things of going through Appendix N and looking at these classics. You know, it's something that John C. Wright, you know, talked about also, that, you know, the fact that, you know, people just are not aware of, you know, where all these stories came from. You know, it's that there was lots of stuff before, you know, Asimov, Heinlein, Clark, and everything else. There's a whole world of authors that got kind of pushed aside and everything else, you know, under, the analog management and everything else. And, you know, I love those authors, but, you know, there's other Golden Age authors too, you know, which you guys have discussed before.
Yeah. Yeah. Another thing that's happening is the mainstream science fiction that's coming out, or, you know, in the people that are in the general fiction, you know, like, Margaret Atwood, for example, you know, the literary folks, discovering science fiction and publishing, books that have been, you know, or ideas that we as science fiction readers were introduced to in the 50s, you know, and then everybody's so excited about it. And it's this wonderful book. It's, it happens again and again.
Yeah. And a lot of times, in fact, I was having a conversation about this recently where somebody was really praising a trilogy of hers and they weren't science fiction readers. And I was like, oh, well, you should really try this and this and this. And they went, oh, I hadn't heard of those things. And I said, yeah, my problem with Margaret Atwood is she keeps saying it's not a science fiction book. It's not science fiction. People sell it as science fiction, essentially. And I was like, but it isn't. She's writing it like a novel. And there's a real difference to novel writing and science fiction writing, where they trust that they're going to just drop you into this world and you're going to pick up context and you're going to just go. And I was like, I love novels of, you know, but not when it's pretending to be science fiction, because then I'm like, come on. Yeah, I got this a long time ago. Right, can we move on?
Yeah, yeah.
So it's interesting watching those crossovers happen. Scott, you were saying that you looked at the Wikipedia entry for this book, and it was mostly talking about how it's about the nature of reality.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, in fact, let me call that up here.
Because I thought that was, went, oh, yeah. As a regular fantasy and science fiction reader, I was like, yeah, okay. I just took that for granted. But it didn't, it made me, you had some interesting things that you had commented on about the nature of reality.
Well, yeah, and because I had watched a talk or listened to a talk just right at the same time. So it was kind of one of those surprising juxtapositions or whatever, or coincidences. The Wikipedia entry for the Ship of Ishtar does talk about, a lot of the people, a lot of the contemporaries and everything were talking about, how it was about reality and sort of a, you know, fantasy versus, you know, modernism and escapism and all that kind of stuff. But the talk that I had watched, or listened to that morning was called, Is Faith Delusional? And it was by one of the guys. I don't know if you guys have heard of Ravi Zacharias.
Yes.
Yeah. So one of his, you know, he's got a bunch of people now. Michael Ramsden is the one who gave this talk. But it was interesting because he talked about Jean-Paul Sartre, he's the one who started to talk about existentialism, which is the idea that you have two worlds, you know, everybody's kind of got two worlds. One of them is in their head, and the world in the human mind is where reason and justice and things like meaning and purpose live, right? And it's the discovery that that world is not the real world, right? So he's saying, okay, the world of existence doesn't have any of those things. And that's really existentialism. So the idea there is that we're imposing our ideas of reason, justice, and meaning and things onto the real world, but the real world doesn't really have any of those things. And from there is where what came, you know, relativity, you know, it's not very far from there that people started to see, not that all people didn't see, but it seems to be the mainstream view that faith is delusional. Faith in God is delusional specifically. And it's a short step from Sartre to that, where you're saying everybody's got their reality and they're imposing their reality on the world and then living as if that is true. But we, of course, believe that there is one reality. And, you know, we're learning about that reality, you know, so the idea that, you know, God is or God isn't, you know, God exists or he doesn't, not both, right, is something that, used to be a basic understanding, but now is not. Right. And a lot of people just, like in The Matrix, we mentioned The Matrix earlier. The Matrix is a movie that basically says we don't know what reality is. You may think you know, and I know that there are a lot of people that say we're living in a simulation, and they're serious. They're saying, yeah, eventually computers are going to get so good that we can make a simulation that is indistinguishable from reality, and therefore we must live in that. Because why wouldn't we, I guess? I don't know.
Yeah, well, all the billionaires with their, they're waiting for the singularity when they're going to download their brain into something, Elon Musks of the world and everything else that, they seriously believe this stuff.
Mm-hmm, right.
Is that transhumanism kind of?
Yeah, it is transhumanism.
Yeah.
Right.
They think they're going to modify their bodies and they're going to be, living to be hundreds of years old and everything else. And that's, and I think, in Elon Musk, I think he said that there's like 90% chance we're living in a simulation, So these aren't stupid people, but they can believe stupid things,
Yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing. And then the idea of faith from there, what the talk went into was the idea of the misunderstanding of the word faith. And there was like something from Dan Brown where Dan Brown was defining in the Da Vinci Code what faith was, and it was basically believing so hard in something that it becomes true for you, or something like that, which, it's like, Dan Brown, no, that's not right,
I mean, faith is almost always the adjective to it as being blind faith.
Exactly. Right.
Is that something you can't prove, that something you... that there's no evidence for it is the way that it's almost always used. And it's the way I thought of it as an atheist, is that, it was something that, wasn't real. And, it was just, we're living in the modern times now. Come on, get with it, people. I remember as a kid, hearing something on the radio, they were talking about, less people going to church and everything else. And growing up in Oregon, this is not exactly a very churched area. I was thinking, oh, this is great. We're gonna see all these churches just go away. Thank you, modern times.
Heck yeah. Yeah. Well, so yeah. The Hebrews 11:1. I'll just quote that. Faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen, and that's King James Bible. But that verse is so misunderstood. Dan Brown pretty much quoted that in the Da Vinci Code novel, but I mean, he completely misunderstood what it says. Faith is a substance of things hoped for. It doesn't mean that the things you hope for become real. It means that they are real. They were real before you existed, right? They were always there.
Yeah.
And it's like faith itself is the substance of things hoped for. It's the result of the things that you are hoping for.
Yeah. And that's then the evidence of things not seen.
Exactly.
That's the result. We can't see it, but the faith is the result of that.
Exactly. Right.
If you go to St. Paul, he says, test everything, hold fast to what is true. Mm-hmm. And so I see that as the main thing is that, no, hey, there's a lot of stuff, that, we need, if we're going to accept something, let's see, what is this built on? How much, can I know that is true? And to revise, once you've done that, as a, I know that myself. I've gone through my whole life having to continuously revise my opinions and everything else because I try to avoid the trap of confirmation bias and everything else, just reading what I want, just to be able to stabilize that, when I was going through my first throes of I was losing my faith in atheism. And so, okay, I'll dose myself with a bunch of Ayn Rand and other atheistic, thoughts and everything else. I was just going to read all these things, and be able to keep my faith in atheism and everything
else.
And that worked for a little bit, but, it wasn't enough to sustain me. That's for
I love
sure.
that you called it losing your faith in atheism, because people don't see that as faith, but it really is. It's an amazing belief as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, there was no scientific test that I could perform to prove that there wasn't a God.
Absolutely.
You know, there was all the rules that I would demand Christians prove to me. I couldn't use those same rules myself, you know, to prove that what I believed was true.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, it's a lack of open-mindedness at that point, which is the same thing that a person who's a Christian might have, too. I like that. Yeah, test everything.
Yeah.
Hold fast to what is true. And that's the great thing about having 2,000 years of Catholic Church thinking behind something. Mm-hmm. There's someone who's asked that same question and undoubtedly been much smarter than me at explaining it. And so that's why, even though I may struggle with some stuff, I can go back and I may not feel it in my heart, which is what people would say faith is, but I can look at the logical reasoning of it, or vice versa.
Mm.
You know, there's a lot of logical reasoning to things that people believe today that I know just aren't really based in solid foundational truth.
Yeah.
But that logic always falls apart. And the faith is what you come back to because that's what holds true. It's hard to explain. That's the problem. Everybody wants stuff explained. We're all so concrete these days.
Mm-hmm.
There's some stuff that isn't concrete like that.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I want to mention for sure, truth cannot contradict truth, you know, by John Paul II.
Mm.
You know, it was exactly what Jeff said, but, you know, from Pope John Paul II, he wrote that document, and that's a document that I've referred to often. So.
Well, Fides et Ratio, I think is the name of the encyclical he wrote.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a beautiful sentence that it opens up with, you know, is that faith and reason are the two wings of a sparrow rising up.
Hmm.
Yes.
You know, that it takes both, you know, that, you know, reason is so important, you know, that we can come to understanding, you know, philosophical truths and to understand reality better through observation. And to test those things and then to revise our opinions on things, you know, just like in science, you know, you come up with a hypothesis, you know, well, this seems to explain everything, but, you know, we found over and over again, well, not quite, you know, we have to dig deeper because there's still other things that we need to be explained and worldviews have to change again. And, you know, we're always going through that process. And the same thing goes in philosophy, too.
And we should be always going through that process, just like you said. You know,
yeah, you can't harden what you think because God's going to come in for one thing. God doesn't like it. He's continually working on us because we don't have the perfect point of view because we're never going to be perfect. We can get closer and closer and closer, but we have to stay open. So the hard thing is you hold on to what you know is true, but you have to stay open to other stuff. And people don't, I think of people of faith as operating that way.
No, I don't.
It's a balancing act.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's where the word free thinking to me shows that very thing. You know,
mm-hmm.
when someone says that they're a free thinker, what they mean, I believe, is atheism. It's a type of atheistic point of view. I think the word has come to mean a specific set of atheistic views, right? That they're calling openness. You know, but what they really are is actually closed to. A large part of the human experience, which is religion, you know, and belief.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. You can have an open mind about everything, you know, but you're not, you know, you're free to think anything, but that there's a God.
Right.
You know, so there's a limit to that. But, you know, as Chesterton said, is that, you know, that we open our mind and our mouths to be able to bite down onto something.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Wow. Well, mm-hmm. Yeah. Nice. Wow. Well, this was fun.
Who would have thought this book would have engendered so much great conversation?
Yeah, it was wide ranging. That's for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. So anything else on the book?
Yeah.
Anybody?
Well, it's worth reading just because, you know, it's fun and it shows this kind of a time period as these types of stories were developing, but it also stands apart as being different from other stories of that time.
Mm-hmm.
And it is really well written. It's so, like we've all said, you know, the prose is very evocative in all the imagery and everything. You really feel like you're there. It's well done.
Yeah. Yep. I agree. It's definitely worth reading. And thank you for bringing it to us.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think I'd have encountered it otherwise.
Me either.
But, But yeah, I'm definitely going to be checking out his other books. You know, I've only read this in the Moonpool, and you know, and he's got one that's called The Metal Monster. I mean, how could I not read that one? The Faces of the Abyss, Seven Footprints to Satan, Dwellers in the Mirage. I mean, these are Burn, Witch, Burn. I mean, my God, these are great titles.
The Metal Monster. It's like the Iron Giant, but with big teeth.
Fantastic.
See it now.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
and you did you guys ever do the Iron Giant on the, on this podcast?
Seems no.
like that's one right up your line. I mean,
yeah,
that's,
no,
but I was just thinking maybe that needs to be my next movie pick after I've already got the next one picked. But it's like, I think like, Iron Giant, I love it so much.
Sounds good. Yes, I do love that movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Brad Bird. I mean, he's just so good.
Yeah.
We did do The Incredibles, and this, Brad Bird. He's just wonderful.
And maybe be doing this podcast long enough for The Incredibles Part 4.
Yeah.
Which is going to be the return to form of The Incredibles franchise.
Or of Pixar.
Yeah.
You know, Incredibles 4. Don't wear capes.
Yes.
That's right.
My goodness.
Oh, I love it. Well, thank you again, Jeff. Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you so much.
That was great.
Yeah, excellent.
So glad.
So next up, we've got The Woman's Balcony, a movie. Yep. What country was that from again?
Israel,
okay, yep.
Just cannot get enough of those Israeli movies.
Wonderful.
First Ush Pizin, now The Women's Balcony. This was a blockbuster in Israel.
Yeah, I loved Ush Pizin.
Good.
So, looking forward to this. So
this is Ush Pizin good, everybody.
Excellent. All right. Well, thanks again, Jeff. And keep Florida running for us, would you?
I'm doing my best.
All right. You're keeping them together down there. Every now and then I see news stories that says Florida's just nuts. So just
I keep running into
sane.
Florida, man.
I love it. All right. And Julie, thank you very much.
As always, super fun.
You bet.
Loved it.
All right. We'll see you all in a couple weeks, everybody.
Yeah. Talk to you soon, everyone.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.